As a member of the church, what Honorable Mark said. Yes, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. My mandate relates to the preparation of these drafts, but obviously the costing of the protection of personal information goal. So my presentation will be restricted to that mandate. If you can go to slide one, you will see that there are three copies in front of you. It will be a presentation which you'll see on the screen with some notes. That seems quite small, that's why we also printed the presentation on a full page. And then lastly, a lot of numbers, which is the costing model, which I'll talk to. So on slide one, really just the overview of the goal, and I think most of you know this much better than I do. It shows you the data flow from the data subject, the consent that the data subject needs to give, the responsible parties, in this case public-private bodies, the notifications to the regulator, so it shows the functions of the regulator, as well as the interaction between the third party who requests these information from the responsible party. So really just an overview as we kick off the presentation. So I see then summarizes our costing methodology and approach that we follow. So what we're saying is we've analyzed the goal in depth, obviously identify all the affected and exempted or responsible parties. We've determined the number of affected entities from the membership list of various industry associations, published industry statistics and annual reports. We've identified the activities of the regulator and the cost of that. And we've used the volumes of these activities as we benchmark it to use in our calculations for the resource requirements. So obviously the volumes and the resources that we found as part of our research were used or formed the basis of our costing model. Then the next slide, just back to introducing the costing options, very critical, or the first step was to identify the affected entities, and there on the left hand side you will see that even though according to the NCO National Credit Regulator report, there's about 407,000 form of entities. In our opinion, after the research, we say that only 60,000 approximately of those entities are affected or responsible parties, so the view will be focusing on this personal information. And on the right hand side, we just indicate the key activities of the regulator, which should be the notifications from the responsible parties, the compliance audit and regulatory monitoring, complaints management, very critical, and also very important for the regulator, the support services. Further on in my time, I will discuss two implementation options. The option A, which is a centralized model or centralized regulator, and also option B, with three regional offices. The next slide then gives you a graph of the implementation of the establishment of the regulator over a period of 12 months. If you look at the first green line there, you will see that she's starting to appoint the chairperson and the ordinary members to meet the secretariat and the lead of the different units appointed by month 3, month 4. Then the staff quite later, you'll see that we've provided there for the office accommodation, the operational setup, etc., and the launch or rollout right at the end of month 12. So obviously this will all happen after the appointment of the regulator or the chairperson by the president. So we'll talk about the self-month establishment of this regulator. Then option A, as I've mentioned, is the centralized model. On the slide, and again if you go to the full page slide, it will give you it will put it a bit clearer. We provide this to our regulator and our four ordinary members as per the legislation, as per the goal. Then we provide it for the secretariat as well as three support staff and 62 staff members. Now, so we quickly just go through it, the blue level there, or the green level up the top, the blue level, that is the management level of the secretariat, consists of the chief operations officer on level 14. Focusing on the four operations and four other managers on level 13, that is the director level in government. All five members of the management team will report directly to the secretary and will be supported by personal assistance. the chief operations officer of the Army Air Force team, which is equivalent to a chief director. These are yellow level, can be any operational level in terms of the different activities that need to be selected. And it's got specialists, for example, in the compliance audit division, compliance management, research, law advisors, and we focused that on the 2013. Using those assumptions and note that the approach to our estimated cost for option A, the centralized model, the startup, we are at $35 million, and obviously for year 1 to 3, you will see it on the slide, $39 million, $41 million, and $43 million. I think it's worth mentioning that the costing of the chairperson and the ordinary members was based on the judges' remuneration and conditions of employment act. All other staff based on the DPSA rules and packages as I've already alluded to. All the other costs, for example, the operating costs, the media launches, communication costs, etc., were based on marketing matters. Option D, Chair, as I said, we provided for 3 additional offices. Now, we provided for a KZN, Western Coast, and Eastern Coast regional office. Merely on the assumption and the statistics that we found on the CISO database, in other words, KZN 65% of the total, etc. So it's not necessarily that it would be those 3 regions, but in case we want to decentralize some of the functions where there are 4 businesses happening, we'll find the structure there. So again, we have the regulator, the ordinary members, the systemic traffic support, and we also have the 3 regions there in the blue line, as you can see, Central Region, Eastern Region, Western Region, a regional manager for all of this, on level 13, director level, 4 other managers also on level 13. I think it's important to know if it goes to those, that is our ICM research, the system would be an essential part of the operations of the regulator. Obviously, a finance, facilities, and human resources unit in terms of support. And you'll see that it's also provided for 1 manager and 1 CA for public relations. Yellow levels to once again all the support staff in terms of supporting that. So, the costing then for a decentralized model for the establishment comes to almost 40 million. Year 1, 44 million approximately, year 2, 46 million, and in year 3, 49 million. These costs, as you can see from the detail, they include all the costs, whether it's human resources, medical premises, equipment, operation costs, communication campaigns, etc. So obviously from a CFO perspective, we recommend option A, which is the centralized model, which is lower in cost. Now, if we look at the current budget that I have available within our baseline, we can avail in the first year, which is year 2011, 15 million, next year 20 million, and in the third year 15 million again. So obviously based on the availability of money, the costing that I've presented here, we're looking at a phased implementation from our perspective, that is the recommendation. And see, just the other document that is also distributed for those members that might be interested is option A and B, the 4 pages with the numbers on. That's the detail of those 2 costing options that I've already presented and be available for any questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for all the work that you've done. How you arrived at the number of 60,000 affected entities, I think over 407. Then I want to ask you a further thing. Because I have been worrying about this requirement that responsible parties must notify the regulator. And let me just say that I'm aware that the bill proposes that those people who have already done their fire manual don't have to notify us. But that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because there are requirements in the fire that don't exist in the fire. But I don't see another one sensible about the other. And I'm looking specifically in section 51F as a requirement that no succession has to give a general description allowing a preliminary assessment of the suitability of the information security measures. I see the logic, but this is a big requirement that doesn't exist in fire. Now, come back to your I see in the search, you allocate under option A, one manager, one PA, one IT developer, two IT support, two data analysts, and one research specialist. And under option B, that remains pretty much the same. You haven't duplicated for the reason. But now, if this bill does go through as it stands, and the preliminary assessment has to be done on the suitability, and later as a complaint stage, no doubt, in case of the village breach, the IT aspect has to be investigated, then surely your IT team is on the small side, or was it thinking that perhaps some of the work would be from the out? And I really want to ask you whether you don't need to do that policy statement, but I would like to argue later, unless persuaded by other factors, that in fact we just think with notification altogether. So that if you cut out notification, to what degree, off the top of your head, would that help bring this projected budget down if you cut out the whole notification layer?
We also need to respond to the detailed questions and then we need to think of the final
Sorry, let me just get one here. Okay, in terms of crypto, there are about 2.5 million entities that are registered, but not all of the entities process personal information. Many of us may have CPs or companies or PTYs where we have our household things, so that's how we eliminated some of the businesses. That's how we went back sector by sector, each sort of industry, and looked at the industry regulators and came up with the bodies that do process information to come to that number of 50,000. Here's a question on notification. If you do get notifications out, there will be quite a substantial decrease in cost. But I would have to go back and rework it, because a lot of the work comes from there. But at the same time, also to answer your question about the size of the IT department, if you look across that, the compliance section, you also see here that you have 25 IT auditors. So within the whole core business, they are the regulation. This regulator, there will be enough IT technology and ability.
Thanks. There's two things. What do you mean by startup in year one? Presumably, startup is the first year. But year two is actually year two. It doesn't make sense the way you count it. I mean, if you look at, for example, the individuals who are paying salary and how it's going to break down, you've given
We have 15 million available, and then the continuation of that, the second 6 months, will be in the next financial year, so we create 20 million rand available. And in the meantime, we need to make sure that that there's appropriation included in the budget process for this public entity. I hope that clarifies the question.
It was very interesting to be having, because it's bigger than 55 million under option A as well. Because it's not, you're saying you're only going to start in September, so startup will then not be 55 million. It won't be 15 million to human resources based on the year's salary. So these figures are not then correct, are they?
You know, they are correct. The costing at the middle age is for a 12-month period for the establishment, as given on plant farm. All that I'm saying is, of course, we don't have 35 million in the first year, but we have 15 million. Let's start in the middle of that financial year. We utilize the 15, and in the next 6 months, in the next financial year, we have 20 million. That gives us the 35 million for the establishment of the arena.
You seem to still be in that spot of the academy. Yeah, let's get this to Marlow, right? That there's a little over tea, is it? I mean, see if you can. I can remember. I haven't seen a problem with coming last year. Linda, honorable?
Mr. Chairperson, the government offices are working together and will be rented or permanent paid for accommodation. I understand the temporary offices but once the regulator moves them to the permanent offices, the road offices will be open.
The costing was done on the basis of rental. The temporary, for the first 3 months. The costing for premises was done for rental of premises, not purchasing of a building. And we assumed in our model that for the first 3 months the chairperson and the other ordinary members can be housed maybe somewhere within the Department of Justice building. So that while we set up and look for the right premises.
Thanks for that.
I don't know what informed him, but it should be. This is a permanent office. It's not something that's been around for 5 years and comes to end.
Don't they want to? It appears like the assumption is that the chair and someone who has it would have to be appointed before.
Yes,
in other words, before you find the problem, and that they become part of the process of identifying the process. That seems to be the logic behind it.
So the assignment is for rental accommodation.
Yeah. Is that up here?
Yes. No, even after that. That was the response I got. The assumption is that it will be rented. After the
assessment,
we base our costing on rent because I don't know if it was even the core business of the Department of Justice property. So on that basis, we cost it on rent. If we can recost for purchasing of a building as well.
I don't understand your comment that the Department of Justice is holding the market is not to purchase properties. Where did that come from? Who said it was? It had nothing to do with my question. I understand the Department of Justice is for business, All I'm asking is, should the department rent for the regulator, or should it purchase outright? Plain and simple.
Do that must have colleagues do this. I think that's interesting. Who will have plenty agencies by the committee. I just wanted to say that the costing is based on rental. If there is a view that the department or the regulator should buy a building, then obviously that will change the costing. But I'm not sure whether that would be feasible at the start-up of this process. And that might come at a later stage, but that will then depend on the budget of the regulator itself, whether it will have enough money to buy a building for the combination.
Maybe my question is a philosophical question. Now, of the various options you've mentioned here, which thing would you tell the department is best? Is there one option, or would it be a combination of options? Because the important thing here is the best out of this option.
I'm not sure where and what, but it's the code that prompts this. I think we should just bear in mind that, I don't know how it works, but there is surely quite a strong case for encouraging the industry to develop and adjudicate their own codes. Once again, I think that could be worth a while from the regulator. The regulator would obviously have to give the group a housekeeping seal of approval to the code, but that is a far less onerous job than triggering them and creating them. And although one shouldn't take the power away from the regulator, then surely. So in a sense, those customs are dependent upon what we do finding difficult stuff. But we should probably think that cost recovery in any form or shape is possible.
Thank you, Chief. In terms of the option A or B or the combination, my recommendation would be to kick off with option A in terms of the establishment, to develop all the systems, to put everything in place, and make it a combination. I will see where the core focus is, where the most information is focused, and then obviously up into the regional satellite in those provinces or in those regions. In terms of the code, what we're saying is the first year of the establishment of the appointment of the regulator will be used in terms of developing these codes and all the other requirements in terms of the law. So the regulator himself will then, in that first year, develop these codes and finalize. And or often we need to just deal with the questions and the salaries, and then the last question is the property salaries, we've not going to costing on that because those decisions, as you mentioned, are not making sense. And so we are, we, you know, we can do those changes.
Sorry,
can
you repeat the
what is the question on the salary of the person based on the salary?
Thank you. I think there was this in this one, I mean, the salary of the group, I actually want to see a very few issues on the and I think the large extent that that's reaching out to, I mean, in the salary of the costing I think we just noticed this fact that as far as the inflation rise that the industry statistics are concerned, there is that possibility. So it will most probably have a lessening effect on the burden of that inflation. To determine precisely the impact of the quantity of the impact, it's difficult to assess. So just on that, strictly speaking, what the bill does not require at this stage is that codes must be in place on day one as approved by the regulator, the bill comes into our. So one could argue that, especially with reference to Bill 56, that the regulator must have time to decide if it should have handling necessary. However, I propose that there will be an influx or a reduced volume shortly after the expansion of the regulator. Personally speaking, the person who doesn't know anything about costing, I suppose that will most probably have an effect on the business as far as being adopted. So there are possibly publications that must be made available immediately. At once again, one thing of the good side of the regulator might also be cost. Cost recovery, there's only one possibility, the first place has to form the call, and that is the regulator acts on behalf of someone in the case in the civil procedure.
But if you, you know, just thinking aloud, if the Auditor General is the prime example of an institution based on cost recovery, you have to pay him when he comes and audits you, you have to pay him the return. And perhaps one could extend that in cases where the regulator ends up having to write the code for the sector, maybe it's overcharge the sector. I don't think that's beyond imagining. Whereas it also gives an incentive for sectors that do produce their own code that most of them will wish to, in fact, to do it, and then you have to get the compliance and knowledge from the regulator. None of this can be answered by you, but this is surely thinking what we do. And lastly, just on the Justice Salary, surely the only other comparable institution which gets the Justice Salary is public protection.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank the level on which you would like to approach the person, and if one is strictly thinks about this level, you immediately think about the judge or the
defendant. I'd like to say that the original suggestion was that the regulator should be remunerated at the level of level 15 in the public service, and that is the level of the deputy director general. We thought that was not enough. And we then recommended that they look at other institutions, as you said, public protector, the national prosecuting authority, and so forth. And the level that is now recommended is at the level of an appeal court judge, which is about comparable to those other institutions that are referred to. Mr. Chief, I'd like to own MPA. National Director of Public Prosecutions, and I think also the, what is that other thing, that other regulator that is person?
Competition Commission.
The Competition Commission, yes.
Human Rights.
Human Rights Commission and so forth. So yes, we looked at the number of institutions, and the level that we arrived at eventually was that of the Appeal Court Judge. We think this is a high-powered position, and it is it would be in line with the other institution.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think if you establish this indication, you have a timeline for use of indication. I think one of the things was the issue raised around where should the regulator be located, should it be on its own, should it be in the right commission. I think maybe there's some argument speaking it with something else, like the right commission, maybe in terms of the cost factor. But I'm not sure why regional offices, I mean, look, that's nothing, not a great thing to fill, that's an operational thing, you made a recommendation. But, you know, it's basically data processing collection and then investigation. And I don't know if you've based the proposal for regional offices on the investigation side, but that would make life easier. But certainly, I don't know if there's any debate you should get into now. I don't see why you need, I mean, this is what we say tonight. And where there are complaints, people can go out and do the investigation. But anyway, I think it has been clear, I think it has been useful, and I do think the cost factor is going to be a problem in terms of what we've got, what we budgeted for, and what their individual costs be. Well, rather than
I don't know that the response is required, but really it's just to give the committee options. But I feel that we are still needing to still need to find out in either operation to
continue to make sure that obviously the costing is based on the bill as it now stands. Depending on what the committee does with the bill, if there are changes, as the Honourable Trump has indicated, then we will have to do a re-costing, and it might, you know, it might change the scenario that we have now. The A and the B models, firstly, the recommendation is that we start off with the A model, obviously. And depending on what happens, there is the possibility that they might be set tonight. But, I mean, that is then for the regulator to decide once he is appointed and operations are started. So what do we go from here? Any questions? Seems to me we can take this step in that sense. Yeah. Like on the nature that the form of the same man. Could you answer a question from Lindal or EBC? Once again, the documents have been distributed. and he can just go through the operation of the implementation plan.
Thank you, Chair. The implementation plan was handed down last week.
Did you present it?
We briefly referred to just explaining the framework of the implementation plan itself.
I thought you were just going to commit your presentation for me. You can just end everything quickly. But it's fine. Let's go ahead with that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I think we can we can more detail. But on the first page, we've got this little spider here that indicates to us what kind of general approach towards the implementation of all the entities will be, and we identified four important components with regard to the implementation of the entity itself. Not the ball or the bike ball general component. Then there's also the fourth component of the establishment of the information protection regulation itself. Then there's also a component dealing with regulations. And then the final aspect associated with the implementation of the act itself is those steps that need to be taken in order for the act to be implemented under the regulations. Proclamation issued to implement the various provisions of the Act. On the little spider strip, we will see that there are going to be four columns with different rows under them. And for example, under general, and very important, Mr. Chair, our very first action will be to revisit our cross-implementation plan. in bracket, under that, we find a reference in the annexure A number 1. So this is just a short description of the first action that we would like to take under general. And then if we find over, we find our annexure, or our annexure, with a table in it. And then once we get in that table, we find the four different components. The general component, the establishment of the information protection regulator. An additional one is the information protection officer on the second page thereof. Then on page 3 we briefly deal with regulations. And then on the very last page 5 the implementation of the Act. But in short, Mr. Chair, what we try to do is just reflect what would have to happen when Parliament approves the bill, or if the President attends to and signs the Act itself. Just to briefly explain the title itself, in our first column, we've just got a simple numbering system going there. In the second column, reflects back to our little spider suite, and then we have an action column. We sort of think to explain to us precisely what we need with description contained in the second column. We've also got a column for responsible parties where we try to identify which components of the department will be responsible to initiate certain steps. And then we've also got a piece of transfer. Mr. Chair, once again, I think at this stage it's not really necessary to go right into the smaller detail of the implementation plan itself. Maybe I can just highlight one or two things for the advantage of the facility leader, just to try and explain how we argue on the basis of the provisions of the goal as they stand at this stage. For example, if you look at the establishment of the information protection regulation, you will see that in the row 5 at the bottom of the first page,
under our action, we identified that it might be necessary for us to determine the formulation and equipment requirements of the maintenance protection regulator, and to initiate steps to secure accommodation and equipment, possibly even determine personnel requirements, investigate the feasibility of the appointment of skeleton staff. Now, this is something that is also referred to in the costing plan, but in a different extent, where the costing plan sort of provides us with a notion that it's important to meet the regulator at the very early stage, during the establishment of the control office, because something makes sense. The regulator would be likely to be involved in the establishment of that office, and especially possibly even the advertising the appointment of personnel. Here we also identified them for certain dedicated officials to be identified, even if it's only in a temporary acting basis, to assist with the all the administrative duties, etc., involved in getting an office like that established. So for purposes of our implementation plan, we simply just said that purely a matter of convenience, offered to refer to that skeleton staff and that acting area. With regard to information protection officers, there's not much that I need to highlight there. I think the detail there is self-explanatory as such. With regard to our regulations, what we did was to identify all the provisions that require regulations to be issued that are contained in the bill. So to a certain extent, the implementation or the draft implementation plan might also be useful for the committee members when we get to further discussion, because it lists now for us at least extracted from the bill where regulations will have to be made. The action column merely then just indicates to us, and this is something general, how we draft our regulations in general. For example, we start off by studying the problem, we define the regulations to be drafted. We then draft regulations, we submit them to the minister and request approval for a process of consultation. We invite interested parties to comment on the draft regulations, we evaluate those comments, and then submit the final draft regulations. Consider the comments by the state board finders and then the draft regulations accordingly, and then we submit our final draft regulations to the minister for approval and then the publication thereof in the prepared. And then the final component of the implementation plan at this stage refers to the implementation of the act itself, and that is where we need to advise the minister with regard to the implementation of certain of people. And that in short is what our draft implementation plan is like.
Is that question?
Numbers?
Thank you very much. This is Pat. And we are at number 4. River, Levin, Margin.
I'm sorry to say, I'm very only have a copy of the agenda. I understand that the number 4 on the agenda.
Are we done? Can you give me the copy? I didn't understand that. First one, how are you supposed to cooperate with us if we can't do nothing? Terrible. I'll tell you the mind. And you tell them.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I should use my logic. Number four is the response of the summary. This year we sent out a document where that document is the last discussion of the summary by the researchers of the committee that was handed out the 22nd of October last week. What we did, Mr. Chair, and at this stage I have to apologize for two aspects, and that is the copies that we have prepared, we apologize for quality to be that. And then when we received the summary from the researchers, we saw that there is in that table two columns, the general and the commentator, and the comment column in the table itself. And we decided not to insert the response part, so what we did was simply under the comment, which is in normal font, we decided just to, where necessary, insert our comment right underneath that, and indicating our comment by way of italics in the yellow arrow font. So we were not able to finalize the document in this case. We apologize for that. We came halfway. So we are still working on that. And maybe just the other matter that I would like to show you at this stage is the research is also preparing the document on issues. So I'm very certain that's the issue document. I suppose that's technically not incorrect, but it's the issue document. At this stage, we ignored that. We understood our instruction from the committee last week to say the response. You will note, however, Mr. Chair, that attached to the document that we handed out now are three connections. The first connection deals with something that we raised during the first part of the document, and that deals with various issues identified by interested parties in the media fraternity, etc. There is various comment letters and submitted submissions to the committee. That is a response to that. That response mainly deals with what we have in the bill, what we aim to achieve in the bill, and how that is aligned to the international position. And we would like to, as soon as we get the opportunity to do that, I suppose we will start on phase one, and I don't know what the format is, how we would like to approach it. We have provided comments, I don't know whether we should read them through, how we would like to approach it, but at some stage we will reach, for example, on phase three of the summary, at the bottom, where we see a reference to the summit. There is a response there, but mainly there are certain concerns that have been raised which directly related to the lecture. I will simply refer to the lecture, and I will request when we get to that, another note, just to take us through the document itself. Fairly long, 15 pages, but I think it's an important response to take into consideration. Then we've got lecture B, which merely is something that is referred to in our lecture A, and we thought that it might be wise to also provide that document to the committee at this stage. And then the lecture C is just a brief comparison with regard to the position in certain foreign jurisdictions, mainly those that were referred to by the commentators themselves. So, Mr. Chair, I'm at your mercy. I don't know how you would like to approach this.
I'm just a little bit. I don't know what to do with the I'm getting the same.
even in a flat computer.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, I think about you, sir. You have to focus on understanding. You have to
what you also mentioned is before we start having a look at the summary of the decision, especially the responses, if I could maybe just ask Mr. Mamba alone once again. When we started to get responses to this document, we realized that there might be four or five issues that one might like to highlight again. It might not necessarily have been expressed as well in our submission or our briefing to the Court of Criminality. If I could ask you to start with that, that would be highly appreciated. And then I suppose that we can run through the summary and then we get to the next day. So once again, I would just take 7-15 minutes to get off the summary and start with the latest explanation.
Thank you. I think I mentioned we did deal with these issues in the original briefing of the committee, but they did come up time again, and we thought that since the committee is now all aware from the practical side of things, they may have a different view on these issues which were in theory on the first day. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but I'm just going to highlight that if you would like to ask questions, you are welcome to do so. First of all, we just wanted to again emphasize the fact that the board is principle based, or outcome based. And the reason for that is really because it needs to be as flexible as possible, since it has to apply to many different sectors and situations. Now, in all these situations, the outcome is usually just be set out in the preamble or in the object form, and the main provisions are really consistent rules which are intended to achieve that outcome. However, in the principle-based legislation, the outcome desired in a particular area is being stated through the principles and also through the rest of the board. And then it's really, it's really mainly the responsibility of the entity who regulates in terms of the legislation, in this case the responsible party, to set up structures and rules that will be effective to those strike outcomes. I can illustrate that with an example. If you look at Principle 7, which deals with the data security, that same principle will be applicable to all responsible parties, and it will therefore apply to a wide range of persons and institutions. For example, the primary school teacher on one hand and the banking institution on the other will both be subject to that principle. And in the first instance, the teacher, it will perhaps mean that she will keep the personal information of her name in a manual register and put it away in an unlocked cupboard. And that will be quite sufficient for the to comply with this law. Whereas in the banking industry, on the other hand, or insurance industry, they may perhaps decide that they will need to encrypt all their laptop computers. So it's a very wide range of issues that are being dealt with. And it is that, for that reason, really, that you will find many words such as reasonably practicable, public interest, adequate safeguards, things like that, that needs to be interpreted in each case, and it will be interpreted differently in each case, as I've shown in the example of the teacher and the banking industry. But this is the only way in which you can really draft a book of this nature, which is really provide a generic framework for the whole country, for both public and private entities. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing that's connected to that is that we say that this is outcome-based. Well, what is the outcome that the law is really aimed at? And I think what is important to note here is that it's really to protect privacy on the one hand, but that's not the only thing. It is also the stated objective of the law to balance privacy with the need for a free flow of information. And where you will see that is that the principle is not stated on its own. It's always, there are always derogations, as we refer to in the Islamic principle, exceptions as we refer to it. So it doesn't, for instance, say you have to collect the information from the data subject personally. It says you have to collect the information from the data subject in the following situation. And then there are a number of exceptions which indicate that it's actually not necessary to collect it from the data subject directly. So it's saying just, you know, the principle says you have to collect it from the data subject personally will not be correct. And sometimes people do not see that it doesn't make that distinction. So thirdly, I think it's also important to note that the law is based on a regulatory model, and there I can explain the difference between regulatory, co-regulatory, and self-regulatory in the privacy fraternity. The regulatory model has a generic act with the regulator, and there are adjudicators, there is provision for code of conduct and adjudicators, but the regulator stays in control in the end. That's why it's regulatory. Co-regulatory, it's the same setup, but once the code has been approved and the adjudicator has been appointed, the regulator then does not have any control over the situation anymore. Self-regulation is what you find in America, where you do not have a right to generic act, and you have different sectors specific acts in some sectors, and the adjudicators are completely on their own. Now, the regulation model has been, we have discussed, was discussed right from the start of our issue paper, and I must say that it has been wide support for the regulation model as opposed to the other two models. So that is why that, you must just remember that that is the model that we are using. Thirdly, the relevance of the EU directive, I think in our response to all the different submissions, we will always indicate whether this is something that's going to impact on EU adequacy, our EU possible EU adequacy rating, whether it's just an alignment with international practice, where it's not necessarily a directive aspect, but it is a line to the system of the international sector, and then it's a purely domestic issue. And then it's a domestic issue, it is quite often being influenced by the fact that we have a constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that's a unique situation that may be distinguish us from other countries. I don't think it's necessary to understand the whole EU directive issue, but just to mention it again, remember that we are trying to ensure that our legislation will be EU adequate, will provide us with an EU adequacy standard. And in that sense, it is necessary for us to have a look at the EU directive and make sure that we actually comply with requirements set out in the EU directive. And then just finally, we want to always look at the information cycle. The cycle starts with the collection of the information, and anything that can happen to the information during that cycle is covered in the Act. So it's from the point of collection up to the time that the information is destroyed. And there are three aspects that one can always look at in any specific situation. The one is that the whole cycle must be covered from collection to destruction. The second is that all the responsible parties that may use that information from the time that it's collected up to the time that it's destructed should be covered in some or other way by the law. And then thirdly, all eight principles must be covered throughout that cycle. So there are three aspects to look at in any given situation. Thank you,
Ashley. Thank you very much. You were saying that there is a plan support for the after the interest was not part of the fight. The need to be going for self-orientation.
I think I would like to suggest that specifically when we get to the amateur that in the society, because we have a complete discussion on this question.
We have questions on this part. So,
I think it's more a question of clarity. You spoke about the different exceptions. Now, how are you supposed to think those exceptions are? Could you reasonably say that cover a very wide range, which is common.
Yes, I think that are recently complemented. I think it also differs. That's also an important point, and I'm actually glad that you made that, that point, because the different countries all incorporate these principles in their legislation, but they don't do it in the same way. So you may find that the principles may be the same in each piece of legislation, but the exceptions may not be the same. So that also depends on the domestic situation in the country and whether they're going to have a constitution or things like that. So it's very important to note that our specific outcomes of this world are the exceptions are very wide. It is still within the ambit of the EU directive, so we can still comply with the EU directive, but we've taken it as far as possible because of the fact that we are trying to, we are not an EU country, and we are trying to balance the free flow of information with the right privacy to the extent that it's possible within the EU directive. But we take it as far as possible, I'm sure, because of the other pieces of legislation in the comparable jurisdictions, you'll find that they're much stricter than we are. And that also has an influence on the way that, you know, you will see now on social media.
Thank you,
Paul.
In the absence of questions, I do accept the microphone to set up a question online. We can move So let's just come to the
Mr. Chair, in the document in front of us now, on the first page, this is where the summary of the presentation will be responses.
To me, it's an issue of do altruistic persons
included. That's the theme. We've got the submissions, and we debate that. We resolve that. If we resolve that they're out, then that deals with a lot of the concerns raised. And you go on like that, and then we can go through and see if there are any other areas that we haven't addressed. I want to basically look at that process being followed. I think it might be easier.
Who would formulate the question? You do have the question.
Chair, they gave us a document.
So
we're going to update it.
Maybe you could do that too.
I didn't say update it.
Okay.
They gave it to us last Thursday. I gather, well, I think they're going to speak for themselves. They now say they're still conceding it, but I have a bit of a problem with that. We got this on Thursday, it was quite a lot of work that was done. We got on Wednesday, I think. Today is Tuesday, I would have thought we could have had an update.
So, and what does that mean? Wait for an update? What does that mean for people?
It's scary. I've also got a slight problem in terms of having to be out somewhere else. But I can come back to this conversation. Look, I it's a pity if they're not ready, but I would have thought that at least we can deal with some topics. If not now, then we come immediately after the house this afternoon. Public participation is one. It doesn't require extensive research. We can discuss what are the complaints raised about public participation. We can deal with any processing is more complicated, but we can select some of these topics to deal with. Maybe not immediately now, but then maybe this afternoon at least, because Chair, we are under pressure in terms of the other legislation that is coming. So I don't think we can afford not to continue today and tomorrow.
I would like to support that, whether it's now or this afternoon, but it's just something that now there's nothing. Which means quite simply we think, and I would agree with the order. I don't know if much we said at the first thing, but they've seen how far we can get towards the progress of this person's issue and a few others. I don't think we should set our minds up and losing it, because we're still starting to looking and relooking and relooking. But then this, I would really support that they start looking at some of these killer issues that's formulated by the decision and discuss them a little bit with us and just in the wisdom of refinement and see how far we can go. There's some issues I think that we can
discuss. Do you want to say something?
Yes, we can talk to you on this afternoon, but it would be better with more.
Yeah, but what seems to be happening is we do have enough people already seeing aspects of the study from the city. So let's see what's up here. And our committee is not going to discuss that in the city, but someone can ask us from number two, identifying the things. The first one, the government has been discussing it. Do you have the person?
Yes, sir. We also have you refer to the issue document. First, you can refer to the issue document. Yes.
You go ahead. Yeah, then next problem. Hopefully, that has had the effect on the
problem. I suppose the issue document in any way flows from its own just a question of order. But yes, there may be some guidance at this stage. We would be able to then seek the issues arise under clause 1. We would like to request that the inclusion of juristic persons if we temporarily stand down there, and I think then something that we can certainly and would like to discuss in the first day on page 4 of the issue document to include the clause, the specific reference at this stage, the limits, that we something that we would like to do. Maybe just provide a short briefing on what precisely stands in that and in that article. But let's just proceed then with your permission. The issue document under this definition clause was indicated that the concerns are in rights with regard to the definition of practicing that is too wide. The definition together with the definition of personal information is far too wide in my impact. Specification by the media. Now, once again, we've got reference to the media in the media. So, you'll most probably stand out with it. So, with regard to the definition or the criticism or the comment that the definition of personal information and processing are too wide, I can refer you to two of our summary documents, the one that we and for example, in the middle of that page where we've got the comment that this is really got a certain number of the information officers, also a concern that definitions are far too high. We first of all also indicate that the definition of certain information is mainly a justification of the definition contained in the information of information. All aspects of the definition are essential elements of the privacy of an identifiable individual, and in order to ensure adequate protection of personal information in the world within the definition of privacy, and to regulate all aspects of the information cycle by ensuring that the whole cycle is gathered from the point of collection up to the point of extraction. And I think this is the essential of the issue that we consideration. You will recall the briefing that we have to do with the information part, the whole cycle of each other. So in other words, from the point of collection up to the point of extraction, and that all responsible parties are gathered and that all bank information protection principles are adhered to through the different stages of the information cycle. According to the issue document, under definitions, the inclusion of juristic persons are also referred to today, but we would like to request that we stand down on that issue at this time. On page 4 of the issue document, which takes us to clause 4 of the bill, which deals with the exclusion clause. Paragraph 4.2 refers to journalists and the concerns raised in that regard. If we could possibly request this load, just to take us to the lecture 8 to the summary document. I think that is the that is the only position to possibly consider those decisions better. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask you to take us to
the number that I love you have has been caught up.
Yes, I'm not sure if you wanted to have referred to any the revision of the process of that being discussed. I think that the exclusion for exclusive agendas purposes has raised a number of issues, and first of all, we can just have a look at the law. It says that it provides for exclusion of journalists from the bill, and says that it must be for exclusively journalistic purposes by responsible parties who are subject to, by virtue of the terms of protection of code of ethics, to provide adequate safeguards for the exclusion of personal information. Now, during the public hearing, we had different stakeholders who made submissions. Some of them made oral submissions, and we also received a number of written submissions. The two oral submissions, or three oral submissions really, were made by Agusa, Simon and ODAC. Agusa submitted that 2 points that they support the bill insofar as the general business activities of the new statute are concerned, but they submitted that the bill offends the constitutional right to freedom of expression and media, in that they say that the data protection principles is sometimes are oppressive, impractical, disproportionate, etc. And then they said that the current exclusion is not enough because the bill does not specify what active safeguards is, and it can therefore only mean that the provision proposed is out to mirror the data protection principles, and they ask for an unqualified exemption. So there are 3 points that are of interest here. First of all, they feel that the data protection principles are unconstitutional, that the current exclusion is not enough, and then they want an unqualified exemption. Comments did not, they opposed the extension. They didn't want a journalistic extension since they wanted journalists to be treated in the same way as all the members of the public. And then they also said that it was unclear what the adequate safeguards were. At the same time, however, they didn't want to fall under the bill at all since they felt that the consequences of the bill was around censorship. And they saw that in when looking at the regulated functions and the fact that journalists had to register notified when it's regulated. And they were not in favour of introducing sufficient personal legislation in South Africa at all. Then we also had written submissions from South Africa, mentioned earlier as well. They also gave a written submission, and they indicated the support for the legislation, but obviously the bill may create a problem for whistleblowers and other confidential sources. I would like to discuss that separately. I am going to refer to that, but it is a little bit off the specific point that we are going to discuss now, but keep that in mind. Then CTV indicates that since there are subjects and clause to the adequate broadcasting code administered by the Broadcasting Compliance Commission, which provides adequate safeguards in their opinion for the protection of personal information, the provisions of the law does not apply to CTV broadcasting activities. So they actually saw the exclusion as being enough to exclude them from the law. NNEP and MultiChoice indicated their support for the protection of personal information and the policies, and did not refer to the exclusion for journalistic activities at all. They only dealt with business-related issues. And the National Association of Broadcasters noted that the law is the end product of the lengthy and thorough consultation process, and it draws extensively on the EU, and committed that the law will impose an additional media regulator and compliance burden on broadcasters over and above existing regulatory requirements, and specifically noted the notification issue, which they thought would be particularly burdensome, and in effect no mention was again made of the exclusion in clause 4B. Now, I think I went into this specifically. I know that it's already been summarized by other researchers, but I went into this specifically to show that there's not agreement between the journalistic fraternity as to exactly what the bill says and how it will impact on them, which I think is important to note. One should also distinguish between the ordinary business and administrative activities of institutions engaging in journalistic activities on the one hand, because they are businesses, and then the actual professional work done by the journalists of these institutions on the other hand. It is the latter part that is dealt with in the exclusion. And then, of course, if you look at the submissions, one should note that a number of things did not feel the need to deal with the professional component, or they felt comfortable with it, and restricted themselves to the business aspects of the issues only. So it's just that one should not think that there's one opinion from media organizations about the law. I think it's just important to note that. Now, in responding to these various arguments, I will look at the following issues. The right to freedom of expression versus right to privacy, the nature of principle-based legislation, the information protection principles themselves, the question of self-regulation, adequate safeguards, the EU adequacy requirements, international examples, and then the last people those. So first of all, we start with the right to freedom of expression versus right to privacy. It was indicated that the right to privacy as incorporated in this bill will impair the freedom of expression. Now, I think right at the outset, we should acknowledge the fact that the right to freedom of expression is an important right protected by the Constitution, the third right to privacy, And neither of the two rights are absolute rights. There are also other rights protected in the Constitution, that also impact on personal information. And it was for this reason that the bill actually aimed to introduce a balance between the protection of personal information authority of subjects on the one hand, while at the same time promoting the free flow of information on the other. And this is the stated objective of the bill. So it can at the outset be agreed that there's no quarrel about the fact that the right to freedom of expression should be properly protected in South Africa. Tries to be effective with citizens, that the right to freedom of expression should in fact be protected, but balanced at the same time with the right to privacy. It should also be noted that privacy legislation, such as the law that we are trying to enact, is found in almost all the democratic first world countries in the world without having had the effect that freedom of expression has been impaired. Inventions of different kinds for the processing of this alien activity are found in some of these countries, some of no inventions at all. And the way in which countries frame this extension, if at all, depends on the context of the particular piece of legislation which is found and the extent to which derogations or exceptions have been included already in the principles found in each act. And I think that is the point that the Honourable Member made this morning, is that what is our law actually used? To what extent is our law already incorporate derogations in the legislation as a starting point? But the point that I would like to make is the fact that it is not the intention of the law to impair the right to freedom of expression as we have established in South Africa at the moment. It is really a question of drafting of the exclusions, the exclusions being drafted to give effect to that position. Now, then the nature of principles-based legislation, I've already in the introductory remarks really explained that to you. It's just the reason why I'm including it here. It's just to say that it is not strange in principle-based legislation to find phrases such as, for instance, adequate safeguards, reasonably practicable, the phrase that you find quite often in the book. And I've actually done a search, search as well, and it is quite often that courts need to determine what adequate safeguards actually mean. So it's not a strange sort of phrase in our law, and it's not a strange to find terms such as, really practical and so forth in principle legislation. It has to be interpreted in a specific sector according to the rules that the South African law on that subject. In terms of Clause 4B, it will therefore be the responsibility of the journalist to ensure that their privacy ethics reflects the outcome of the business rule. And we've already seen that the outcome, the stated outcome, is the proper balance between privacy and freedom of expression. Now, if we look at the information protection principles, I think that is where the major problem really came in with the submissions that were made. The board makes provision for exclusions, exemptions, and exceptions. And exclusion will have the effect that the board will not be visible at all. Now, that is what is being asked, is a blanket exclusion. Exemptions will mean that specific, and the board makes provision for exemptions as well, that specific principles will not be applicable in a specific sector or for a specific data responsible party. And you can apply to the regulator to have those principles to be exempted from those principles. And then exceptions is the third category, and they are built into the principles themselves and should be regarded as qualifications that determine the scope of the principles. Now, that is really what is very important in this third category, very important for this part of the discussion, because the argument stating that the information protection principles will curtail media freedom and thus define the infringe on the freedom of expression has simply been based on an incorrect reading of the law. Not an incorrect interpretation, but simply an incorrect reading of the law. Because the existence of these exceptions has been completely ignored in the argument that they're aimed at objecting to the provisions of Clause 4B. And with that, among others, claims that the principle should have the effect that the consent of data subjects would be necessary before publication of newspaper articles. Alternatively, that an exemption would have to be obtained from the regulator in each case before an article could be published. Now, a correct reading of the principle is incorporating the exceptions in each instance would actually be as follows. Principle 1, it will just be the responsible party, the journalist must ensure that the principles are complied with, that speaks for itself. Principle 2 says personal information must be processed lawfully and in a reasonable manner. Consent is not the only requirement reflected, but is merely one of six possible options described for processing information if you look at clause 10.1a to f. Now, option 6, one of those options, for example, provides that personal information may also be processed without consent where processing is necessary to pursue the legitimate interest of the responsible party or of the third party to whom the information is supplied. Now, journalism is certainly a legitimate interest and press freedom is protected in the Constitution. So this law provision is only subject to one qualification, and that is reflected in clause 10.2, namely that the data subject may object to the processing if the objection is on reasonable grounds and in a prescribed manner. This is, of course, in accordance with the current position where any person reads the subject of a newspaper article may approach the press ombudsman or even take the newspaper to court if offended. So that is the partial concern concern. The submissions actually reflected that consent would be necessary for the processing of the information, and that is not simply not true. Principle 3 says the clause provides that personal information must be collected for specific lawful purposes related to the activities of the responsible party, in this case it would be journalism, because it's a lawful purpose. As a general rule, the data subject must be made aware of the purpose of the collection. However, this is again not necessary where compliance with clause 13 would prejudice the lawful purpose of the collection, or would not be reasonably practicable in the circumstances of the particular case. So, there are two exceptions, or where the information will be used for historical statistical research purposes. They are self-explanatory, and it's really unfortunate that the interested parties did not take the trouble to discuss the impact thereof in their submission. Clause 14 provides that personal information must also not be retained for any longer than is required for achieving the purpose for which it was collected. In the past, journalists are concerned, one may argue that personal information may be kept indefinitely, as is the case for the archives for research purposes. So, principle 4, further processing must be compatible with the purpose for which it was collected. The journalists may only use the information, therefore, for purposes compatible with journalists' purposes. Principle 5 says the responsible party must take reasonably practicable steps to ensure that the information is accurate, complete, must be not misleading and have data identity. Principle 6 says the responsible party must notify the regulator of its intention to first process personal information. Notification is given once only, except in circumstances where it's changed to the extent that it's not merely of extreme importance. And then notification exemptions are granted in terms of the Promotion of Access Information Act will also be applicable. If you go through, you can see if you go through these principles, not one of them actually impairs on the work that journalists are doing. But if you do not take the exceptions into account, then surely the arguments will stand. It is also true to far special personal information concern that for the 25 to 32, I think much was made of the fact that journalists often report on things like philosophical beliefs, political opinions, health, sexual life, criminal behavior, etc. And it was noted that there were specific exemptions in the bill for these actions. But the general exemption that indicating that the restriction does not apply when processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of the right or obligation in law was completely ignored once again. Since the right of freedom of expression and press freedom is protected in the Constitution, it is significant that this exemption will also apply. So, it should be noted that where a responsible party identifies the need to request an exemption by the regulator of one or more of the principles in terms of clause 34, on account of the fact that it would be in the public interest for that responsible party not to comply, taking account of the facilities, this exemption is provided once only. It's already been shown that the legislature should be able to function quite comfortably within the ambit of the principles. However, should there be an unforeseen circumstance which they need to apply to, or they need to apply to the regulator for the pension, this will only be necessary once. So they will not, the pension will not be provided, because of the general nature, it will not be provided per article that is written. It will be the fact that journalists will then be exempted from a specific principle in the Act, and that will be a general exemption which will be there forevermore. So the position pitched where a newspaper has to accept permission to publish every time one publishes an article appears to be without any merit. And I have to stress that, you know, you only have to ask to be exempted when you cannot operate practically within the principles which you will be shown should be quite practical for newspapers to do anyway. So this is just for exceptional circumstances. And I think that is the position the exemption is being one, and that is it. So, and I think it's extremely important to note that the discussion so far has not even taken into account the fact that there has been an exclusion provided for newspapers. It is only taken into position as if the bill is decided to be applicable to newspapers. This brings me to the question of self-regulation. It was alluded to the fact that the church, when you see self-regulation, the bill is wide enough, you see all activities dependent, and that is true. It is supposed to apply to everything that anybody does, so it will basically apply to every activity of journalists. But it should be noted that in the first published draft of the bill, that was just a discussion that the Commission did not make provision for any specific exclusion for journalistic purposes. And the reason was, as I just explained, that we thought that the exceptions contained in the principles were extensive enough to enable normal law for journalistic activities. However, in the final report, after receiving information from the journalistic fraternity, the current exclusion was included in order to make provision for a form of self-regulation. And this was done in order to emphasize the importance of the right to freedom of expression and press freedom. It followed heated debate, since not all stakeholders were convinced that the press needed special treatment. I think they followed the climate position which has been discussed in various court cases as well, where it was stated that there should not be a special treatment. However, it was decided to provide them with a form of self-regulation. Now, the effect of that self-regulation for journalistic activities, as distinguished from other activities covered by the law, would be as follows. Where the journalist is subject to a code of ethics, providing the adequate safeguards, and I will come to adequate safeguards just now, as required in terms of the rules, the Act will not be applicable at all. The drafting of the code will be an internal matter and does not have to be signed off or approved by the regulator. And the regulator will have no jurisdiction over the professional life of journalists. Should the regulator receive a complaint from a data subject, the regulator can only determine whether the code actually contains adequate safeguards. And if this is the case, the data subject will be referred back to the sector adjudicator. Now that's important because the Act will not be applicable. The code will be an internal matter. It is for the journalists themselves to decide and self-regulate them. And the regulator will have no jurisdiction over the professional life of journalists. We thought that that was the widest possible exemption that we could provide, especially if looking at the directive, and we'll come to that just now. This position should be distinguished from the ordinary position in the bill where industry-specific codes of conduct will exist. With an industry-specific code of conduct, the Act will still be applicable. The drafting of the codes are regulated through a prescribed process, and approved codes can be withdrawn or re-evaluated by the regulator. And the sector-specific adjudicator can deal with the complaint, however the data subject would in the normal course have the right of appeal to the regulators who will have the ultimate say. So it's not it's a very wide exclusion that's been provided because it will actually impact differently completely on the position in the gender of concern if it's compared with all the other institutions. As I said, the bill is based on a regulatory model, and that was canvassed and supported by the majority of stakeholders throughout the 6 years that we investigated this issue. No other responsible farm in the province is such a fee self-regulated or self-regulated status. It was therefore regarded as the broadest and most unrestricted possible exemption that could be provided. And we can also look at the EUAC in international examples just now. Okay, so if you look at the actual safeguards, this has been already noted that the outcomes-based legislation requires that the NCD regulator should take the responsibility to ensure that the desired outcome set out in the legislation can be realized. That is a position for all responsible parties, not only for journalists. This feature of the bill has in fact been welcomed widely by responsible parties in the private sector who see the code of conduct as an opportunity to ensure effective involvement in the drafting of the provisions that will actually be applied to the sector. The exclusion of journalistic activity in the bill was based on a similar provision in the Australian Privacy Act, and a copy of the Privacy Adequacy Standards of the Australian Press Council drafted in response to the Australian exclusion in such as Answer B. And perhaps if you could quickly have a look at that, just to have an idea of what it really would entail if it's in your handout Answer B. There you see it is the Privacy Amendment Act that is effective in December, and the Australian Press Council has developed such a set of standards to comply with this Privacy Act. If you look on the third page, there you see the media organisations and the relevant publications which are submitted to these standards on the written schedule, and then start with collection of personal information. In the new journalists receive personal information only in the public interest, and then it just explains how that principle will be applicable. And it goes on with using disclosure of personal information, quality of personal information, security of personal information, anonymity of sources for which you can send it in balance, sensitive personal information, and what that is. This is a four-page document, and that is the way in which they deal with it in Australia in terms of the Australian Privacy Act. It should be noted that the Australian Law Reform Commission is at present reviewing the Australian Privacy Act, and in its presentation to the ALRC, the Press Council actually indicated that the exclusion provision was working well and that they did not recommend that it be changed. It has been in operation for about 5 years, and that is what they recommended, that it shouldn't be changed. Now, it is true that the bill does not provide criteria for determining what adequate standards would entail. The bill envisages that these standards will be developed within the journalistic sector without intervention by the regulator unless they are challenged. And the reason why this seems to be a viable option is because of the fact that there are already various oversight bodies, and we discussed it in our report, working in terms of code of ethics that exist already. And these codes of ethics already embody the spirit of the bill, of this bill, although they do not specifically refer to any of the data protection principles. So it was envisaged that these codes could just be expanded within the spirit of the existing provisions to incorporate the data protection principles. The common law and the case law has also been well developed in this area, and taking into account all these guidelines, it is difficult to understand why it should be regarded as an insurmountable problem to determine what adequate safeguards should mean in the context of journalistic activity. However, since this issue has been raised as a problem, consideration may be given to amending Clause 4D so as to circumscribe the search, and possibilities in this regard could be to require that the code of ethics should be drafted in consultation with the regulator, or that the code of ethics should be signed off, or that the regulator should certify them, or stipulating that the safeguards contained in the code should comply with specific principles in order for it to be adequate. It is possible to do so. But it should, however, be noted that this will restrict the institution. And I think with responding to criticize Clause 4D envisaged this problem, and that is why they either requested the blank exclusion or no legislation at all. But see how it was discussion on the EU, and that is what I'm going to look at now. It is important for South Africa to obtain EU adequate status, and the EU directive does not provide for a blanket exemption for journalists. Article 9 says member states shall provide for exemptions or derogations for the purpose of authentic or listed expression only if they are necessary to reconcile the right privacy with the rules governing freedom of expression. It then goes on in disciple 57 to explain that no derivations from the rules of security, that is 57, shall be possible, and that supervisory authority is responsible for the flexibility provided in certain ex post facto powers, such as the power to start the regional report or to return matters to the judicial authority. The EU Article 29 Working Party also made a recommendation about data protection and media, and they in fact stipulated that data protection law does in principle apply to the media, that derogations or exemptions are granted only in specific areas, and that the supervisory authority responsible for the sector must in all cases retain its post-party power. The derogations must follow the principle of proportionality. What is important is that it should only be granted where it is likely to jeopardize freedom of expression and only so far as necessary. The derogations is mentioned already in your bill to be taken into account, and I think that is the main point in as far as our legislation is concerned, that it already allows a satisfactory balance between liberty and freedom to be struck. So it would then not be necessary later. In fact, refer specifically to Article 11, which says when assessing exemptions, one has to consider the obligation to inform that the subject does not apply when this is involved in disproportionate effort. Now, that is exactly in our law as well. You can read the rest of it, and we've been reading it, you will realize that we have given very, taken to heart everything that they have said and tried to incorporate that in our position in 4D. It also says that in evaluating whether exemptions are proportionate, attention must be paid to existing ethics and professional obligations of journalists as well as to the self-regulated forms of supervision provided by the position. So the bill is really trying to give effect to the EU directive precept through the exceptions or the derogations to the various principles, the self-regulatory supervision provided for journalists, as well as the authority provided for the regulators to provide exemptions on a public interest basis and to determine the adequate safeguards provision should it be challenged. Now, let's just quickly look at international examples, because that has been referred to as well. Most countries do provide for exemptions for journalists' services. However, there are no blanket exemptions in legislation that has received EU adequate status. It's important to put the last thing. Because there is one country that I know of, Canada, that does have a blanket exemption that I will discuss just now. In Europe, Belgium, Spain, and Portugal have no express exemption. Sweden, Germany, France, the Netherlands, United Kingdom, Austria, and Finland do have exemptions from some of the provisions in the legislation, however, no blanket exemptions exist. Insofar as OECD countries are concerned, it should be noted that the legislation is based on the OECD guidelines, which only provide that the exceptions must be limited to those necessary and in fact expired. So it's a little, the EU directive is stricter than the OECD. It should also be mentioned that some of these countries already had their legislation in place before the EU directive was enacted. That, for instance, New Zealand already, the legislation dated from 1973 already, and the directive was only 1994. That's 3 years that they had legislation before the directive came in. I've already mentioned the fact that the bill follows the Australian example, which seems to be working well in practice. The Australian example has, however, been criticized as being too broad. In fact, the Australian Law Reform Commission was amended in 2009 with exclusion to amend it to make provision for the development and publication of criteria for adequate media privacy standards and a template for media privacy standards that may be adopted by media organisations. And these criteria must be developed by the Office of the Privacy Commissioner in consultation with the Australian Communications and Media Authority and key media representative bodies. So I'm just noting that the example that we are following has actually been criticized as that the Australian government is discussing the possibility of actually circumscribing the adequate standards. In Canada, the Personal Information Protection Procedure contains a wide exemption. However, since this act applies only to private sector organizations that collect, use, or disclose personal information in the course of commercial activities, and the professional component of the institution really excluded. It is important to note that Canada has many different pieces of legislation that deal with protection of personal information. They have the Act, the Privacy Act, that deals with government institutions. Then they have the Privacy Act, this one that actually only deals with those private entities that deal with commercial activities, in the course of commercial activities. And then they also have provinces, legislation for each province. So there are about 7 or 8 pieces of legislation that is specifically with information protection. They also have regulated, specifically related to information commissioners and the data protection commissioners in each of these sections. So they have a very wide ambit of legislation. It is also important to note that they don't deal with, they don't have generic acts. They deal with things more on a more ad hoc basis. So the way that they deal with the information is different from South Africa. That is also true in things that they this subpoena, which actually sometimes this wide extension, is also combined with the Electronic Document Act, which should be the same as our EPC Act. It does have a different ambit therefore. And it also does not, it's not the same as the South African legislation in that it doesn't contain the limitations or the exceptions to the principles that our legislation contains. So it's important to note that you cannot really, from look at the Canadian example as an example that is similar to our position. And very important is that the opinion 2 of 2001 on the adequacy of the Canadian Personal Services Act recommended that any adequacy findings should reflect the limitations in scope and implementation. So, although this is one example where you do find a wide extension, I think there are many things that distinguish this country from South Africa. There is an annex C as well with examples of the international legislation. I'm not going to take you through that. However, I would like if you would just have a look at the UK legislation, for instance. I think one must look at the complete section when trying to decide how it should be implemented. And there it is important to note that it says in there, section 32 of the UK Data Protection Act, that's in Annex C. It says that processing for the special purposes, which is limited to the assessing material, can be excluded on the public interest provision, having regard in particular to the sexual importance of the public interest, including the expression, etc. But that doesn't end there. It then goes on in 3 to say, to determine whether the need of the data controller that publication within the public interest is a reasonable one, regard may be had to the compliance with any further practice which is relevant to the publication in question and which has been designated by the Secretary of State. Now, I think that, you know, one needs to be very careful because, first of all, this exemption in the UK doesn't provide a blanket exemption, it provides exemption from specific principles. That means that the Act is still applicable and all the other sections of the Act is still applicable. Notification and enforcement and monitoring and all of that is still in place. And it is also the public interest provision, which is being submitted as a good idea, must also be, very much the same as the adequate safeguards principle, because, I mean, how do you determine what is in public interest or not? It is the same bad judgment that has to be made when you have to look at what is the adequate safeguard or not. And what they have actually said is that you will determine that by looking at the compliance with code of practice once again, and that code of practice must be designated by the Secretary of State. So it's a much more restrictive exclusion than the one that we proposed in our legislation. I think it's just important to note that what we have provided is really the widest possible provision that we could make.
If we look at the findings related to provisions regarding whistleblowers, although of course this is serviceable and we will actually discuss this in the committee at some further point, it's not really within the ambit of the discussion. The purpose, the section that is in contention here is the purpose for which information is collected and that it should be used for the same purpose. Now, when we deal with this, we'll look at the position of journalists. Journalists collect information for journalistic purposes and they may then not sell the information or do something else because they have to use the information for that purpose. The provision regarding whistleblowers is regulated from their perspective and given that the purpose of the reporting system for whistleblowers is to ensure proper reporting of governance, which is the difference if they do not report because they want to be journalists. They report the wrongdoing or whatever they want to report because they want to ensure proper corporate governance. And the data collected and processed through the reporting scheme should therefore be limited to fact related to this purpose. And something heavy like these systems should clearly define the type of information to be disclosed, who they should disclose to within the scheme, how it should be limited, and it should be limited strictly and objectively where it's necessary to verify the allegations made. So, although it does fall within the ambit of the bill, because it forms part of the whole information cycle, it will not be dealt with in the exclusion. Even in Canada, when this data exclusion was put through Parliament, it was noted that that it's not new with the exclusion, it's not new with the information gathering or the informant, the informant position in the whole information cycle. What is usually done is that, and this is something that we can consider when looking at this position specifically, is that we can include a specific provision for journalists to keep the source of confidentiality, because that is an accepted practice in our world as well as internationally. So I would just like to conclude. The following possibilities for dealing with the process of personal information for exclusive journalism purposes have been identified. A completely unqualified exclusion, an exclusion for journalists to the extent that they are subject to certain conduct. This would be an amount that would overlap to the exclusion, but this is actually not an additional exclusion being necessary because we have those conduct in the bill. An exemption from certain of the data protection principles that is quite often found in the legal law. And then an exclusion amounting to self-regulation as suggested in the bill, so you can stop there, or if you're not happy with that, if you want to have some more information on what adequate safeguards are, you can then subject it to the development of criteria to determine the ambit of what that safeguard should be. But as I said, it expands previously that would be a restricted permission. Now, I'll just look quickly at all of these. The blanket exclusion would become contrary to the prevention of the indirectors. I think that is quite clear. If you, and this complicates other applicable to state, I think this is the position in Canada, is that they do not have a blanket adequately stated. One can consider that possibility for South Africa as well, but one must think about it carefully, because if you have the opportunity now of wanting to all dealing with this whole issue, it will then just be a question of pre-flow information, irrespective of which industry or what you are dealing with. If you are going to impose certain restrictions on yourself, then what you can do to get out, there will be then not impossible to comply with the indirect. It is also not in accordance with international best practice, because there are very few. I can only find out, as far as I know, it's only Canada that has ever had a blanket extension. Most people, they extend certain of the data protection principles, but that's a stricter principle than we have. And there also seems to be no reason why journalists should not be subject to some of these obligations, for instance, to keep the information safe, or not to fill it for direct marketing purposes, or to ensure the quality of the information. These principles are not really negotiable, and there doesn't seem to be a reason why journalists should not be there in journalistic activities.
So making the next one, making gender subject to the ordinary provisions of the bill regarding service conduct, but they may, that may be the message that freedom of expression is not an adequate possibility in the ultimate bill. And that is why it was changed from the discussion paper bill to the actual report, where we did provide them with the freedom of the self-regulation permission. Then the third one is intervention from certain data protection principles. That will be, as I said, in accordance with the provision in most countries. It will, however, be a much stricter provision than the current provision, since the Act will still be applicable in all respects, except for those provisions which are specifically excluded, and the regulator will still have jurisdiction. Should this be the option chosen, it would require a tailored partial exemption from the provision used in disclosure, as well as active intervention principles. In this regard, it appears that there is no reason why the media should not be subject to the same obligations as other businesses in relation to data quality and security, transparency, and overseas transfer. The exemption should also only apply to the genuine concerns that there is well with the media. I think it's just also important that these principles will be, if you just take some of the principles, the effect will be that the journalists will shortly have to comply with the rest of the board. That is the final option is this is the only really valid function in this rate, and that is that it was not clear what the criteria would be for determining the actual safeguard. The exclusion can stay, but have a sub rules which can indicate that the criteria must be developed by the information protection regulator in some self-sanction is speaking here with the legislative body and the public. To determine what the safeguards should be regardless of being adequate, and once the question has been settled, the media organization should then be left to self regulate and the act will not be accepted anymore. So that is the question that we have to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we can safely break the bandwidth that is sufficient, and then I pray on coming back.
I want to give you an early argument that you reply, but then I really need some information on something you said. Firstly, you made the point when you said that there was no uniform response from the media community. Firstly, I think something must be pointed out as the following. As to the entire broadcasting industry and the provision of the NAB to which you pointed and those of NNET and other shows to which you pointed, there's a very clear and obvious reason why they wouldn't have approached towards 4G. And even though under our Constitution, Section 192, the broadcasting in this country has its own regulator, it is there for the public interest and to ensure diversity of views and opinions. Only broadcasting regulator that I regulate broadcasting. That already writes and prescribes and gives a code of conduct. So they sit under their unregulated and the ultimate regulator in any case. And I would venture that that must be the reason why they didn't, this issue is lying in on that today. It was noticeable that there was a different approach coming from Sanders and from Dr. Dario Rudolph, who acted for Abusa. It is not clear to me why they took the kind of position that they did, and it's of no concern to me, except that I'm very interested to hear from you that there was extensive engagement between the Law Reform Commission and the media, and I understood we should understand it, and they would need to debate, which to me increases the puzzle as to why they should have come with this submission, if they were in fact part of those earlier discussions and deliberations over the last 9 years. Where far from the left and down. But then it's just an information question. If I make a new argument, our Constitution makes clear of broadcasting regulation. The only reason why it is permissible to regulate broadcasting is the frequency, the scarcity doctrine, the lack of frequency. That doesn't mean you can regulate print ever. You can't, as far as I'm concerned, under the freedom of expression. Broadcasting functions on frequency, and that is scarcity, therefore, they must be regulated. So now on the print sector, you've argued that we need to comply with the EU data directive, and I've studied your document with interest and would like to discuss further basically what degree we are done.
But surely, under our own constitution, that is our primary imperative. And I would venture to argue at this point that ours is one of, I think, two constitutions in the world, right-based constitutions in the world, that explicitly constitutionalizes media freedom. And I believe that justification now for taking a different path from the kinds of rules that have been written under the EU State Directive for journalism. And I remain, for now, persuaded by Dr. Dario Lino's approach. I like the idea of saying that the act does not apply to the processing of personal information by any person for any gender, signature, or artistic purpose or for material. Therefore, to concentrate on the activity rather than the sexual. Because I think A, we have the constitutional representation of that media freedom. But B, you know, the technology changes all the time. And what about bloggers? There's no way you can catch bloggers under a code. Anyway, not that. And the bloggers, the internet is an anarchic arena. It's glorious for free speech. It has grown and grown and grown to the point where it impinges on our commerce and the way we do everything. And therefore, a form of regulation has become necessary. But you can, fortunately, never stop the individual who starts being a blogger and engaging journalism and on himself. You can't catch a mantra code, I don't think. So for now, I think that we can do the straight approach of simply saying that there's no scientists, deliberate activities, and that's what I would say. But I am thinking that this is some of the arguments. But I want to give you one last one, why it probably has created more trouble than it would to write the exemption in full detail. And that is, you point out that every single principle has its exceptions. And you cite the pursuing rules of state, but if you're pursuing your legitimate interests, then you don't have to do the asking, the data subject, the consent, and the this, that, and the other. And now speaking from the point of view of the bill, but that is part of what is problematic about the bill, of course. Right from our first session, I think the problem is supposed to point out. If you have a clause this wide at the bottom of each principle, which kind of negates everything you've read before, you must have consent, but it's all right if you're pursuing your own legitimate interests. Give me another example. Information must be collected directly from data subjects, but if you're pursuing a so it makes a difficulty for the bill itself. And I think that's another reason not to try to catch too much under your wide dangers at the bottom of each principle. So for now that's where I stand. But I would like to study your paper more carefully and to learn more about the exceptions and the data directive requirements. Thank you. This engagement that occurred between the Senate and the media over the years preceding the book, what was that?
I think, if I'm to clarify that, we've had our consultation that came through our documents, written submissions, and workshops. And what I was referring to, the two things I think we've sort of drawn together, and that's not true. The consultations took place by way of written submissions of previous and we actually in our report gave effect to, we've actually discussed in the report the submissions in quite detail, the actual submission that was made. And so in that sense, we have taken into account the consultation and the views of the media. However, the heated discussions that I was talking about was really in our process to the commission, and to the committee and the commission itself, where the idea that we would give specific exemptions to journalists was challenged. So it was not the heated discussions was not with the media.
I think we can do that. We can get the loop from the other.
then we can come back.
I just want to touch on some of the points you made. I've jotted down, I think I may have used some of them. Just in the part of technology is concerned, this is really one of the objectives of the law is really to make sure that the law will be adaptable, so that we really have to move all, and that's also why it's so widely stated and so forth. So it is hoped that we will be able to deal with technology as it develops without having to change the law. However, in the past, lobbying and so forth are concerned, that is exactly why we incorporated, because that was one of the points that we discussed in our discussion paper when we did not include an exclusion, was the fact that it was so difficult to determine who the journalist is there. Because every person, you know, any person can publish anything as everyone becoming a journalist. So that is why we didn't include it, because we thought it should be, there's no reason to have a specific to deal with journalists in the discussion separately from other people. But that is why we also thought that was a way of protecting the privacy principles if you only give the exclusion to people who are subject to code of ethics for them to self-regulate. Because, I mean, the self-regulation really means that they have something in place, whereas bloggers wouldn't be able to self-regulate because they don't have anything in place. Just as far as the principles and the exceptions are concerned, it's very fine to balance, and that is really developed, of course we use examples from other countries, but it is really being developed, and if you look at it carefully, I'm sure that you will find that what it means is it's not just a blanket saying, all of us do this, but not allowed to do this, you know, in the exceptions. It's actually saying, under what circumstances are we allowed to do it? And then it's phrased very carefully. And that's where the reason is practicable, and those things need to be incorporated in a code of conduct. So it's not going to be possible in a code of conduct to say, oh, I find myself in this exception, and therefore I don't have to comply with the principle. You always have to comply with the principle. But you are complying with the principle in a way that is reasonable for the sector in which you are dealing with that principle. So it's not that the exception negate the principle. It actually just explains the way in which the principle needs to be applied. And because we use these words, that will be then decided in the code of conduct. It will mean this for the primary school teacher, it will mean something completely different for the banking industry. But those of them can use this principle when drawing up the code of conduct or when evaluating their conduct as to whether they comply with the principle. So the principle will never fall away. It will just be interpreted in a way that is appropriate for the sector. And we argue by experience in education that that's actually applicable to journalists as well. So they will actually have freedom to do whatever they need to be. If I think I've forgotten the other, but anyway, please come back to me.
Thank you,
Adam.
So
we'll
look at what I've said. And then the first one, I'm sure there is something else.
Thank you. I think in total it was put a member to not be but then at the same time a lot of them are ready. So I think you know if you know the budget is a challenge, they are to be that we can cut them because you know they don't have to be
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, I didn't stop this because I was very scared that something might happen to it.
Look who's seeing you.
Mm.
Yeah.